BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is the second of three programmes all dealing with the same theme, the future of health. Last week we looked at cancer. Next week it'll be what the artificial intelligence revolution means for medicine. Today, though, I'm exploring what has widely been described as an epidemic, this time of anxiety and depression. The data appears alarming. Surveys suggest that one in four, or maybe even one in three of us, will suffer from these conditions during our lifetimes. And it's now estimated that these mental disorders account for 12.5% of all sickness leave in the UK. So how should we read these alarming statistics? What do they tell us about what's happening inside our heads? And what could we do about it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's go straight to the mental health data. What should we make of it? Jennifer Wilde is a consultant clinical psychologist and professor of experimental psychology at the University of Oxford. And Dr. Jennifer Dykeshorn is a psychiatric epidemiologist at University College London. Jennifer Dykeshorn, there's an awful lot of discussion at the moment about what people have called an epidemic of mental illness and so on. Is it broadly true that we are seeing significant increases in people suffering and reporting mental health problems?
Overall, we do seem to see an increase at the population level in people showing up to their GP for treatment for depression or anxiety or other mental health problems. We also seem to have some evidence to indicate that there's an increase in symptoms over time. So in the last 10 years, we are seeing more people that are scoring highly for symptoms of anxiety and depression over time. So there does seem to be some indication that there is an increase in the levels of anxiety and depression in the population.
Okay, before we go further, Jennifer Wilde, what do we actually mean when we talk about anxiety and depression?
Anxiety is a feeling of being on edge, a feeling of threat, like something bad is about to happen. Depression is indicated by low mood, tearful, low motivation, feeling quite worthless about yourself. The two often co-occur. So it's rare to have depression without anxiety. And typically when individuals are extremely anxious and it's been persisting for some time, they do develop depression.
Right. Okay. Jennifer, while we have these big figures often reported in the press that here in the UK, one in three or one in four people are now suffering from anxiety or depression. Can we track down where those statistics actually come from?
So the statistics come from large studies that assess anxiety or depression by self-report measures or by broad-based questions about having feeling anxious or low in mood. This is quite different from a structured clinical interview. And we know that self-report measures can overestimate rates of anxiety and depression for a number of reasons, the main ones being they don't assess level of impairment, so whether or not these symptoms are impairing someone's life, and we often don't know the duration of symptoms. So to meet a diagnosis, we do need to know whether symptoms are impairing somebody's life and for how long those symptoms have been around.
Right, okay. How reliable do professionals believe self-reported statistics are? And maybe we could talk about both the advantages and pitfalls of using them.
When we talk about self-report, that encompasses so many different methodologies of asking about mental health. So it can range from a single question on a questionnaire that says, do you have anxiety or depression? Or have you been diagnosed by a healthcare provider with anxiety or depression, to these very extensive, structured interviews. And there's quite a range in there, as you might expect. And we see very different results when we look at these. The benefit of using things like the structured clinical interviews is that they have been validated in different studies in different contexts, and it does allow us to look over time. However, the picture of what that means is really different. So, for example, population level self-report data on, you know, just your general score on mood, sleep, anxiety, that sort of thing, might differ a lot from clinical data. It does give us a really useful snapshot of what's happening in the population, though, because it does tell us people's subjective experiences, what they're currently experiencing. But interestingly, when we think, how that relates to what's happening in terms of the big picture. Someone might score really highly on a depression scale or an anxiety scale, but they may not say that they have depression or anxiety. They may never go to their GP to talk about anxiety or depression. So we're seeing very different pictures when we look at self-report symptoms versus clinical experiences versus, you know, whether you ask someone if they have anxiety or depression. So it's interesting. However, I think all of these are really useful pieces of information. It just really depends on the question that you're asking and understanding what the data comes from.
I imagine it also makes a difference how you use and then report that data and how you look at it. Because Jennifer Wild, one of the things that's been said, in addition to people saying we've got an epidemic of anxiety and depression and mental illness, the other thing that is often said is that actually we're pathologizing normal human emotions. You know, we're bereaved. That happens to everybody, but we are encouraged to describe it as somehow being a mental illness. Is there any truth in that?
Sudden bereavements are considered to be traumatic and called traumatic bereavement, and they can be associated with post-traumatic stress, depression, and complex grief disorder. Grief, of course, is normal, but it's going to be more difficult, and it will feel like a disorder for some people, particularly with those sudden deaths. In terms of anxiety and depression, and are we pathologizing it? Again, I would really come back to clinical impairment. So to what extent is somebody experiencing anxiety or low mood, and it's really interfering with their daily functioning? And I think when you have those two points together, so somebody has symptoms, they're feeling anxious around other people, and that means they're not socializing or they're not able to attend school, for example, that is clearly an anxiety problem. Whereas when someone feels anxious, perhaps taking an exam, and they still take the exam, that's normal anxiety. So I think one of the ways to differentiate, is it normal, are we pathologizing it, is really to look at this question of clinical interference. How much is it interfering with somebody's capacity to function, to take care of things at home, to maintain social relationships, and to be able to work or engage with school?
Jennifer Dykstra, I think that takes us neatly from, if you like, the self-reporting element of finding evidence and what is actually happening clinically and what can be measured by practitioners. You've done quite a lot of work on this. What do the clinical records and the clinical research you've been engaged in tell us?
Before we get right into my research, I just want to say that the definitions of the disorders, like how many symptoms you require in order to receive a diagnosis, also changes over time. So the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, it used to say that you couldn't be diagnosed with major depressive disorder if you've recently been bereaved. However, they removed that in the latest thing, and that caused a great amount of discussion.
Does that mean at the point that you change that diagnostic level, all of a sudden a whole lot more people mm-hmm. would come into the depressive category than had been before?
Absolutely. So this is something that requires contextual information. So as soon as the guidelines change, we may see a huge jump. And then when we just look at an overarching trend and we see, oh my goodness, something really bad happened in the UK in 2006 because all of a sudden we have a jump in anxiety and depression. If we don't have the contextual information to inform this, or we don't know that, okay, there's now the removal of this bereavement exclusion, so we would expect to see some amount of increase in depressive disorders. So it's really important then to have that knowledge when you're interpreting these types of findings.
Jennifer Dykstra, let's look at what we can say from your studies about differences, let's say, within this country and within regions of this country. Do we actually find significant differences between different places?
Yeah, absolutely. So just a tiny bit of background on the study. We looked at 20 years of GP records, which included over 29 million people, so patient records that have been de-identified. And this is the electronic health records of people receiving treatment in primary care for common mental disorders, including anxiety and depression. So obviously, the last 20 years, there's been extraordinary change in every single area of life. So we wanted to see if there were an increased rate of new cases. So is the rate of new people presenting to their GP with anxiety and depression, is that changing over time? And the second question was whether there are certain groups that are affected more by this. And so what we did find, we found clear evidence that the overall incidence, so that rate of new episodes of common mental depressive disorders increased over time. And in terms of the scale, it changes from about 55 per 1,000 person years to almost 80. So that's an annual average of how many new cases are showing up at the GP. When we looked at differences across the UK, we did find very striking differences. So overall, if we think of sex, we overall find females have higher rates of both anxiety and depression across all time points. However, the trends are quite parallel. So the rate of increase that we're seeing in females is echoed by the rate in males. It's just kind of two parallel lines trending in the same direction. When we look at age, that's where the most striking findings we found, because the youngest two age groups, so those basically under the age of 25, had a really striking and potentially worrying increase over time, more than doubling from the rate that we were seeing in 2000 to what we were seeing at the end of the study. And we did see other really interesting differences in terms of regions and also across the devolved nations as well. So we saw, for example, the rate in Northern Ireland was actually the highest at the beginning of the study, but towards the end of the study, the rates in England were higher. So just to pause for a second, this is a very high-level descriptive study where we're just looking at trends over time. We're not able to really say why this happens, or we have some theories, we have some things that we are exploring in more detail in subsequent studies. Is this a difference in the way that GPs are picking up, screening, treating, recording? Is this differences in population levels of symptoms of anxiety and distress? But is this a change in people's willingness to present to GPs to talk about mental health problems? There's a lot of different potential explanations, and that's kind of the next step for the next studies. Basically, this study shows these really interesting trends over time.
Jennifer Wild, how do you look at that data and what do you think about it?
The differences in gender are fascinating, and we know, for example, social anxiety is a very common mental health disorder. Fear of public speaking is higher than the fear of death. Public speaking is a form of social anxiety disorder. And girls present with higher rates of social anxiety disorder than boys. Yet if we look at individuals having treatment for social anxiety disorder, typically it's quite balanced in terms of gender representation. So I find that quite interesting that the research suggests that there is a higher prevalence rate amongst girls, but treatment seeking seems to be broadly similar across the genders.
Which would seem to mean that a higher proportion of males feeling that way or diagnosed that way are seeking treatment.
Well, a higher proportion than would be expected given prevalence rates are seeking treatment or having treatment.
That was Jennifer Wild with Jennifer Dykeshorn. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about avian flu, the one about the online safety bill, and the episode asking if the UK is prepared for more floods. Back to anxiety and depression. Now I want to focus on the prevalence of these conditions among young people, the causes, and what we know about the effectiveness of treatments. Jennifer Wild is still with us, and she's joined by Dr. Sharon Neufeld from Cambridge University Medical School and Talia Ely, Professor of Developmental Behavioural Genetics at King's College London. Sharon Neufeld, if I can start with you, what do you think may account for the increase in anxiety and depression we think we're seeing among younger age groups?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, social media is one of the things that's on a lot of people's minds. And we've had a look at some of this. When you look at these large cohort data sets, the Understanding Society data set, and it seems to be that we can explain about 10% of the cohort changes based on young people's increase in social media use. So that's something. It's a small amount, but there's still a lot that's unexplained. Also, when you look at changes over time, again, this is from 2010 to 2020, we're finding that there's a decrease in young people engaging in sport, and that explains about 5% of the effects. And there's also a decline in parents' mental health, and that explains about 5%. So we still have a lot of unexplained effects in terms of why we might be seeing an increase in mental health problems. But those are a few contenders.
Tali Ely, that suggests that we should be very careful before we embrace overarching theories about declining mental health.
Absolutely. And one of the most difficult things about mental health is that it is so complex and so many factors are involved. And one that hasn't been mentioned yet is delays in adult milestones, which are really quite significant in the generation currently in their 20s, where they are experiencing particularly high levels of anxiety, especially women.
So what do we mean by that?
So the age at which you move out of your parents' house, have your own home, have a secure home, the age at which you have first secure employment, the age at which you have your first child, the age at which you first have a car, all these milestones are really substantially delayed in this generation. It's likely to be partly because of the financial situation that we are facing as a country, as a, you know, globally. It may also be because of COVID that has been exacerbated. But we've seen these changes for quite some time. It's not just COVID.
Why would that have an effect on your mental health?
So if we step back for a minute and think about what the purpose of anxiety is, it's a very, very old emotion. It is an animal response to threat. Its purpose is to gear you up when there's a threat to either flee and get yourself safe or to attack and get the rest of those around you safe. And you can see, therefore, that when there's threat around, people are more likely to experience anxiety. Now, these days, threat doesn't necessarily mean a bear coming and attacking the group that you're living with, but it could mean that you are constantly being expected to live in substandard accommodation where you're very insecure about whether you'll still be able to be there next month or not, and that you're unsure whether you can pay your bills, and that you can't do the things that you would like to be doing in life because of these sorts of financial insecurities. And so I think this element of uncertainty about life is extremely likely to be important in what's happening with anxiety rates.
So it's not just the delay which is involved here. It is the question about when you will ever be able to do any of the things which you have set up for yourself or which seem to be set up for you as the markers of your progress through life.
Exactly. And the fact that those who were in young adulthood 20, 30, 40 years ago, you can see huge patterns of change in, for example, when people could afford their first home. And I run one of our national longitudinal cohorts, the Twins Early Development Study, and we've actually done some focus groups with our twins recently to hear from them what they feel is affecting anxiety in their generation. And this factor came out loud and clear in every single group we spoke to. It's a really major factor for them. And this sense of shame that in their mid-20s, they still have to live at home because they simply haven't got the job security or financial wherewithal to be able to afford housing in the current climate.
Jennifer Wild, what do you think of these correlations and possible causes?
I think when we look at anxiety, it's also important to look at what's maintaining anxiety. So there are a number of processes that maintain anxiety, and avoidance is one of them. So financial constraints will absolutely affect adult milestones. But then a vicious cycle can set in place where being at home becomes familiar. It gets more difficult to face your fears and do what's best, as opposed to what's easiest. And it can be easiest to avoid when we're feeling threat or perceived threat. And this cuts across all of the anxiety disorders.
That's really interesting. And Sharon, do you think there's evidence that adolescents, as opposed to younger adults, I suppose, are more likely to be affected by some of those stresses or potential stresses than older groups?
Well, I mean, certainly the more that we learn about the brain and how it develops in terms of young people, their social cognition, we're finding that it's not just age 18 that there's this cliff edge and suddenly you're an adult. So the concept of adolescence has expanded into at least to the age of 24 or 25. Some people would consider up to the age of 30. So this is very much a formative period when a lot of these behaviors can embed, which also means that it's such an important period for prevention of mental health problems as well.
Okay, so those are some of the theories behind why more young people appear to be experiencing anxiety and depression. Now I want to find out about possible treatments. Talia Ely.
Yeah, so there's a lot of work being done now to try and think about how to intervene early. And that is to teach some of the strategies that are found to be effective in the strongly evidence-based psychological treatments. So the best known of which is cognitive behaviour therapy. And so these would be strategies to tackle some of the common behaviours and thoughts that you see along with anxiety. So Jennifer mentioned earlier avoidance. And instead of avoiding the things you're fearful about, but in fact confronting them, gaining the support you need to be able to experience those challenges, and then getting that sense of, oh, I did it from having faced it, is a really important tool in helping people understand how to cope with stress. And then also you have to think about how to help people cope with the thoughts they have about feeling very anxious, and learning how to recognise those thoughts and being taught strategies to push them away. There are different strategies that are taught within CBT, cognitive behaviour therapy, that could be being taught at a younger age. This is a quite rapidly growing field of research to try and work out which approach to teaching this to our teens is going to work best. And given that the average age at which somebody who's going to experience crippling anxiety during their life has first experienced it is the age of 11, which is when they leave primary school in this country, this is something we need to be tackling in secondary school at the latest.
Sharon, you were nodding along as Talia was speaking there.
Yeah, and I think also understanding the social environment that supports the young person or doesn't support the young person, that is such a huge, important part when we think about young people's resilience and their ability to cope, as well as acknowledging and dealing with some issues that people might have had growing up in terms of any abuse or neglect that they might have experienced. So these are all really, really important pieces of the puzzle.
Talia Ely, if you don't get this kind of treatment, is there any suggestion that mostly you will recover anyway? Or will you actually lead to long-term problems?
So some people will recover, and anxiety does sometimes go up and down. We all know that before a big period of exams, for example, many teenagers are going to be feeling anxious. But for those children for whom it becomes debilitating and they can't concentrate, they can't focus, they maybe can't even get into school, then it can begin to have knock-on effects. And that's where you see a really difficult, vicious cycle that these young people can get into, where it's had an impact not just on their learning, but on their normal social experiences as a teenager. And one thing I would add is that it's very common for anxious teenagers to have anxious parents, and anxious parents are going to be much more likely to be able to support their teenager in dealing with and coping with their anxiety if they also seek treatment themselves.
Right, so this is really important, Sharon. You not only have to try and deal with the child and the adolescent, but you also may have to treat the parent.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are interventions that dyadic intervention, so that means for both the parent and the child. For example, mindfulness CBT, so the target is, of course, the young person. So they're the person that's presenting with the mental health problems, but it's acknowledging that the parents often also have a mental health problem themselves. And so by integrating the same intervention for the parents as for the children, they can also help each other in the process of doing their homework, for example, related to their treatment. And the learning that each of them is experiencing, ideally, though, they're going to be discussing at home and further embedding that. So these are really promising, again, emerging approaches that are just being tested in large trials.
Talia.
One of the things we know about what causes anxiety is genetics. And so that can sometimes be part of the reason why you might have an anxious parent when there's an anxious child. It's unlikely to be important in these increasing rates that we're seeing, but it's probably a source of vulnerability that makes some individuals more likely to become anxious when they experience the sort of threats and difficulties that we associate with anxiety.
Yeah, and it's important to make the point, really, isn't it, that it's not just the increased rate you have to worry about, it's the people who are anxious and feeling depressed all the way along.
Absolutely. I mean, those individuals will potentially be in their 40s or 50s now, but there's always a population rate of anxiety. And, you know, 30 years ago, maybe it was 20%. Maybe now it's nearer 30, 35%, different in different age groups. But the key thing about how genetic influences impact the situation is that they likely lead to differences between people in how they respond to, experience and cope with stress.
As a society, Jennifer Wilde, do you think we are in a good position to get the help and treatment of those who need it, or have we got a long way to go?
We're making progress and we have a long way to go. We know that individuals who are more socially disadvantaged do have higher rates of anxiety and depression and are not well represented in services. So we still need to discover ways of reaching the hard to reach individuals or who aren't presenting and ensure that the treatments are nuanced and acceptable to such individuals and also similarly effective.
Sharon Neufeld, that poses the possibility that actually the people who take up the treatment may not be the people who need it most.
Yeah, that's right. In my work, we've actually shown that there was an over sevenfold decline in depression cases in those who accessed mental health services compared to those who had not. And that was over 3 years' time. And so this was really encouraging. And we've been able to show similar things both in adolescents and in emerging adults when you think about psychiatric distress, psychological distress that they might be experiencing. When we're talking about who gets the services, just one positive note is that we found when we've looked at the national survey data on mental health of children and young people, rates from 2004 versus 2017, it actually appears that we're closing a treatment gap for ethnic minorities because we're actually seeing a lot more non-white children and young people accessing services compared to the earlier data. So that's really encouraging and could be pointing towards a reduction in social stigma around accessing services.
Tali Ely, let's imagine for a moment that, resources are going to be limited and we have to decide where we're going to target help. How do you think we should best think about targeting that help?
So the natural starting point would be young people already experiencing anxiety. But I think building on what's just been discussed, we need to think very carefully about how social disadvantage fits into this. So we've shown in a couple of different data sets, and other people have as well, that your level of education is associated not only with your seeking treatment, but your receiving treatment. So the higher educated families, higher educated young people are more likely to seek treatment and they are more likely to receive it. And so if we're going to truly tackle this, then we need to be finding a way to make sure that everybody is aware of the support available, regardless of, for example, educational status. So I think it's going to be important that we somehow get learning about this and about what the support available is into our schools.
That was Talia Ely with Sharon Neufeld and Jennifer Wilde. My thanks to them and to Jennifer Dykeshorn. We'll be back at the same time next week.